Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A few years ago, today's guest, best-selling author Peggy Orenstein, realized that her daughter wouldn't be a little girl for much longer. When her daughter was in preschool, Peggy Orenstein did extensive research about the Princess Industrial Complex. And based on her research, she was convinced that its innocent, pink, and pretty culture was priming little girls for something more insidious. And for Peggy Orenstein, that is happening right now. She began thinking about sex. Do today's young women have more freedom than their mothers to shape their sexual encounters? Do they have more influence and more control? So she began to interview high school and college age girls about sex, self-objectification, internet porn, hookup culture, and sexual assault on college campuses. In her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape, Peggy Orenstein writes, quote, "They talked about towing the line between virgin and slut. They told me about boys who were aggressive and boys who were caring, boys who abused them and boys who restored their faith in love. They admitted their attraction to girls and their fears of parental rejection. They talked about hookup culture, in which casual encounters precede emotional connection, now commonplace on college campuses. It was rapidly drifting down to high school. Fully half the girls had experienced something along a spectrum of coercion to rape," end quote. Many of the conversations Peggy Orenstein had were very disturbing, but these are conversations we need to have. Peggy Orenstein is the author of many books, including the best-selling Girls and Sex, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and the classic Schoolgirls, Young Women, Self-Esteem, and the Confidence Gap. She is a contributing writer to a number of publications, including the New York Times Magazine and the LA Times. And Peggy Orenstein will be speaking at Books, Inc. tonight in Berkeley at 7 o'clock. She will be in conversation with a high school student. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and Peggy Orenstein joins me in studio. Hi, Peggy. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back. Yeah. So last time you were on, we were talking about your book about princess culture, Girls. Cinderella Ate My Daughter. I loved that title. And your daughter is now in seventh grade.
Uh-huh.
And so it got you thinking about what's next after the princesses.
Yeah. And, you know, there was part of me that really didn't want to know. I was hearing a lot of stories about hookup culture, about sexting, about binge drinking, and, you know, but parenting from ignorance and fear, you know, always a good strategy. So I thought that's not going to work. And at the same time, we were having this larger conversation in the culture about sexual assault and about consent. And that's like, it's such an important conversation, for kids to know the ground rules of sexual interaction. At the same time, it was becoming an end point rather than a beginning point. And honestly, you know, I mean, consent is kind of a low bar for a sexual encounter. Like, I was not assaulted, kind of a low bar. What I really wanted to explore with young women was what was happening after yes, and how that was affecting both their perceptions of themselves and their own sex lives, and also how it was feeding into some of what we're seeing in the larger culture in terms of sexual violence.
It's such a good point, because we're having so many conversations about sexual assault, about catcalling. In California, we now have a yes means yes law.
Yes, we do.
So politicians are now addressing this, but we're not really talking about what happens before that.
Well, or instead of that.
Right.
Right? We're now talking about healthy relationships. And one of the things that we're most silent about is female sexual pleasure and how that silence also feeds into this. I mean, one of the things, skipping kind of ahead here, if you don't mind, but one of the things I talk about in the book is the way that we perform what I call a psychological clitoridectomy on young women. And what I mean by that is that when we have our babies, we have our infant boys and our infant girls, and we tend to name all the parts on baby – I mean, at least we say, here's your pee-pee on baby boys, something. And on girls, we go right from navel to knees. And there's no better way to make something unspeakable than not to name it. And then they go into puberty ed, and they learn in fourth or fifth grade, you know, that boys have erections and ejaculations, and girls have periods and unwanted pregnancy, and not the same thing. And they see that, you know, diagram of the internal organs of a girl that look like a steer head, and then it grays out between the legs. So we don't say labia. We don't say clitoris. No surprise, fewer than half of teenage girls have ever masturbated. And then they go into their partner encounters. And we think that somehow they're going to have a voice. They're going to have a say. They're going to think it's about them. You know, it's setting them up. And I put this into a framework of what Sarah McLellan, who's a psychologist at University of Michigan, calls intimate justice. And that is, you know, just like who does the dishes in your home, just like who vacuums the rugs, sex is political as well as personal. And it brings up these issues of violence, of personal power, of mental health. And we have to ask, you know, who gets to engage? Who gets to enjoy? Who's the primary beneficiary? How each partner defines good enough? And honestly, I think those are very hard questions for us as adult women. But with girls, you know, I just didn't want their early sexual experiences to be something they had to get over.
Hmm. When we talk about what girls and boys are now facing, you think about, well, I grew up in the 80s, really, mm-hmm. 70s, 80s, and we had Madonna's Like a Virgin. We had some sexually explicit rap lyrics, but it was pretty tame. I mean, when I look back at high school photos, maybe you thought you looked kind of hot and sexy, but we looked kind of dorky. I mean, it wasn't really that sexy back then. And we definitely didn't have internet porn.
Right.
I mean, there was Playboy at the grocery store, and people would go and put other magazines behind it to kind of flip through it. But that's it.
Right.
And so talk a little bit about the major differences between, say, the 80s and what girls and boys have access to now and what they're exposed to now.
Well, you know, it's a 24/7 media culture out there, and they can get anything that they want to or don't want to often see at any time. So one of the things that's been a real game changer is porn on the internet. Mm. And it's so ubiquitous, so accessible, and kids see it whether on purpose or not on purpose as young as 9, 10 years old. Often, you know, before they've had any kind of interaction, before they've held hands, before they've had a kiss. And there was a survey of college students in England that showed that 60% of them consult porn in part as sex ed. And, you know, that is really not where we want our kids to be learning what sex is. It's commodified. It shows distorted bodies. It often erotizes humiliation of, and degradation of women. And it was affecting the girls that I spoke with as well as their partners, whether their partners were female or male, in terms of their own sense of what they should be able to do, what they should like, how they should look. And they would say things to me like on the – this is the more G-rated and friendly for radio. And they would say, you know, my boyfriend wants to know – why I don't make the noises that girls in porn make when we have sex. And my journalistic remove would kind of crumble. And I would go, look, it's a movie. And a movie has to have a soundtrack or it's a silent movie. So, you know, I mean, they have to make noise or it would be a silent movie. And that would be like sort of like a revelation to the young women. So it really was seeping in.
Well, since you brought up porn, let's just start talking about this. For people who don't know what is easily accessible right now online, can you give us a quick overview?
I don't know. Can I? I'm on the radio. Can I?
Well,
I mean,
oh,
you name it,
okay.
And it's out there.
Yeah, no, I'm glad.
Why don't
you, said
you
that.
Tell me what I can? What you read the book, so you tell me what we can say.
Well,
here.
I did want to say that because maybe if you have young children around, some of these things might be a little explicit. But basically, anything you can imagine is available
online. And anything you
online.
Can't. And in a click of a button and often accidentally.
Right.
And so, and you know, it's kids know on one hand that porn is about as real as pro wrestling. But it's there and it's arousing. And of course, they're going to, if it's there and it's easy, they're going to look for it and they're going to look at it. And I think it's hard sometimes for us as political liberals and as feminists to discuss it, because it feels like we're being sex negative. And of course, there's the odd, you know, the occasional feminist porn site or, you know, that sort of thing. But I feel like porn is fundamentally conservative in the way that it constructs female sexuality and female pleasure. Often in porn, the most insidious thing is when you see somebody doing something that is degrading to a woman and she says no. And then a few minutes later, changes her mind and enjoys it. And there is research that shows that young people who consume a lot of porn are more likely to believe rape myths, that young men and young women are less likely to intervene if they see a potential assault in progress, and that young women who consume porn regularly are less likely to recognize when they are in a dangerous situation. So it is having an impact on their safety, as well as their perception of one another and their perception of sex, because it's just so much more intense and so much more ubiquitous than it was in our generation.
You write that over 40% of children ages 10 to 17 have been exposed to porn online, many accidentally. By college, according to a survey of more than 800 students titled Generation XXX, 90% of men and a third of women had viewed porn during the preceding year. On one hand, the girls you met knew that porn was about as realistic as pro wrestling, yeah, as you said, but that didn't stop them from consulting it as a guide.
Yeah, exactly. And so they would, you know, there were I'm trying to think of radio waves. Always radio waves. Say this. Yeah. There were acts they were performing that did not feel. I mean, again, you know, girls. The big. There were a couple of significant points that all were about the disconnect between girls performing sexiness and understanding their own sexuality. And porn was part of it, but it was mainstream media as well, because those ideas had filtered into mainstream media. And so the pressure on girls was to be hot before they were anything else. And when we talk about hot, that's, you know, that's the idea that how your body looks to others is more important than how that body feels to you. And whereas Gen X parents or baby boom parents may have pushed back against that idea as a form of self-objectification and harmful, for today's young women, it's sold to them as personal empowerment and confidence. So it's much more confusing if, you know, supposedly, if you're in control of it somehow. And so I would talk to girls about that. And, you know, one young woman said to me, she showed me a picture of herself dressed in, you know, a crop top and high heels and a little dress and a little, you know, skirt, and said, I'm proud of my body and I never feel more liberated than when I'm wearing skimpy clothing. And then a few minutes later, she said that she wouldn't have worn that outfit a year earlier because she was 25 pounds heavier. And so, you know, as she put it, some jerky guys would have called me the fat girl. And so then, you know, you have to ask. I mean, of course it feels good to show off the right body and get, you know, be affirmed and be envied. But who gets to show off which body under what circumstances, and how liberating is that if humiliation lurks right around the corner? And we know that self-objectification is linked to body monitoring, is linked to eating disorders, is linked to, you know, cognitive issues, mental health issues. And in a real bait and switch, it's linked to lowered sexual satisfaction. And so you have to say, you know, I mean, so often for the girls, that confidence came off with their clothes. And you have to say, who cares? Mm. Who cares how proud you are of your body's appearance if you have no understanding of its responses?
Do you think that this is widely known, that self-objectification has been associated with depression, lowered GPA, distorted body image, eating disorders, risky sexual behaviors? Do you think that's widely known?
I think it should be. You know, I think what I felt was there was a real knot. You know, I use the word complicated in the subtitle of Girls and Sex for a reason. And part of it is this real knot that girls are tied up in around self-objectification and how we push them to be sexy, then demonize them when they are. And one of the things that comes up a lot is dress codes. And I talk about that a little bit in the book. And telling girls, you know, that you shouldn't dress this way because it distracts boys, that's an unsupportable position, because ultimately it doesn't, you know, when do boys become responsible for their own behavior? Is it when you wear a knee-length skirt? Is it when you're wearing a burqa? You know, that road only leads to she was asking for it. At the same time, it's hard to support the idea that dressing in ever more provocative clothing is a feminist act when we know that self-objectification is harmful to girls. And so I think that one of the ways to approach it with young women is to talk about the research and talk about and look with them at media and look with them at research that talks about self-objectification and talk about the culture rather than demonizing the girls.
How does social media play into this? Because you report that three-quarters use two or more social networking sites. 92% of teens say they go online daily. 24% are online almost constantly.
Well, the selfie culture is really a teenage girl culture, much more than teenage boys. And girls, it's interesting because they report that their own selfies make them feel more confident, but when other people post pictures of them, then their confidence is reduced, perhaps because they're not as conscious of the angles as they are. But also, you know, the whole issue of, you know, what we call Facebook envy now, that idea that other people's lives are better than yours, that they're, you know, happier than you, that they're having more fun than you, all of that. And what, you know, I think social media can be great. Mm-hmm. Social media can be great. It's really fun. I think we all struggle with, you know, doing it too much, whatever. But and it's been a boon to LGBTQ kids who may need support and can find it online. It's been a boon. It's been tremendous for the activists who are fighting rape on campus. I don't know that they could have done what they've done without it.
Right.
And it encourages. It's another way that external. To, you know, self is something external is reinforced for young women, that the idea of yourself as a brand that you're marketing to your, you know, 987 BFFs or whatever it is. So so many of the comments on girls' pictures are about appearance, and they know they're going to get more comments with bikinis than with parkas. So it's another thing that encourages and reinforces that idea that you are how you look, you are how you look, you are how you look, and you're not who you are, you're not how you feel, you're not what you feel.
Today, I am speaking with Peggy Ornstein about her latest book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Peggy interviewed over 70 high school and college-age girls about all of these issues, about sex, sexual assault, porn, self-objectification, and also pleasure. And we'd love to hear from you. If you are a parent, how do you talk to your kids about these issues? Or if you were like, some parents don't talk to their kids at all. What advice do you have for other parents also? What questions do you have for Peggy about what she found? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I was thinking about myself there because my family didn't talk about these issues at all. So if that's the case, what do you do? And maybe you're an aunt who's talking to a niece because her mom doesn't do it.
Right.
So what advice do you have for parents who might not be comfortable about this or do not know how to navigate this new landscape? 866-798-8255. If you're a young woman and you'd like to share a story, we'd love to hear from you. Also, if you're a young man, what are your thoughts about these issues? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's go back and forth between some of the more disturbing things you found in your book, but also
a bit of the happy things.
When you interviewed these 70 women, and we'll talk about who they are, but what did they say about pleasure? What does that mean to them in this landscape?
Well, that was one of the things. As I said, we have been silent.
Right.
We have been silent in this culture about female pleasure. And so what they learn is that their role, that male pleasure is more important than theirs. And so one of the places that was really apparent and something that we need to broaden our definition of sex when we talk to young people, because by focusing on intercourse, we are allowing other acts that they engage in to become not sex. And when they're not sex, then they're not subject to the same rules around responsibility and around respect. And so particularly with oral sex, it was so much of a one-way street with girls, you know, girls performing to boys. It was considered no big deal. It was considered less intimate than intercourse, as long as it was going that direction. And girls had a lot of reasons for doing that. It was, you know, it gained them popularity. It was a way to distance themselves emotionally, to avoid what they called catching feelings, like it was a disease. From boys that, you know, they feared if they had intercourse, they would be too emotionally connected. It was a way to get out of an uncomfortable situation, many things. But I heard so many stories of one-way sexual acts that I started saying to girls, look, what if every time you were with a guy, he asked you to get him a glass of water from the kitchen, but he never got you a glass of water? Or if he did, you know, it was like... well, you want me to, you know, it was like totally begrudging. You would not stand. I mean, these were smart, strong girls. We haven't talked about who the girls were, but they were smart, strong, ambitious, feminist girls. And they would laugh when I would say that. And they'd say, you know, oh, well, when you put it that way. And I was like, well, why wouldn't you put it that way? But, you know, Rose, the thing was, it wasn't just that the boys didn't want to. It was also that the girls didn't want them to. That the girls had, and they talked about this a lot, that they had internalized very negative feelings about their own genitalia, partly because, again, we don't talk about them. So they felt a combination of that they were simultaneously icky and sacred. And as I said, you know, they avoided anything except for removing their pubic hair, which was ubiquitous. So the only time they were going down there was to remove pubic hair. And I don't, did you see that article the other day in the New York Times about labiaplasty? Did you miss that?
So, but I read about it in your book.
Yeah. So there was just a piece in the on the Well blog in the New York Times about the rise of labiaplasty has gone up 80% since 2014 among teenage girls.
And what is this exactly?
So you I had to look it up the first time I came across it because I thought, oh, I don't know what that is. That is the trimming of the inner and outer lips of the vulva in order to create what they call a clamshell appearance, similar to, they use the word Barbie. Because Barbie's made of plastic and has no genitalia. And so I think as a result of the pubic hair removal, there's been this new scrutiny. And it reminded me of, you know, when we first started shaving our armpits and our legs, it was in the 1920s when flapper fashions revealed limbs for the first time. And suddenly women's limbs were open to public scrutiny in a way they hadn't been. And, you know, the labiaplasty thing, it's extreme. Those girls are canaries in a coal mine. But it's about the most intimate part of our body becoming open to public scrutiny and the expectation that it be prepared a certain way and that it look a certain way and that that look is, again, more important than our own enjoyment. And, again, that comes straight from porn.
And this procedure is increasing?
Yeah, it's gone up 80% in teenage girls. The American College of Obstetrician and Gynecology, this came up because the American College of Obstetrician and Gynecology felt they had to issue a statement about it to say it is medically unnecessary, it can be harmful, it reduces sexual function. I mean, I thought, my gosh, I've written against female genital mutilation in other cultures, and I've written about women in those cultures who are fighting that practice. And here are teenage girls voluntarily doing this because of the cultural pressure around beauty that we place on them. That is, frankly, crazy.
You have to wonder, why are the parents allowing this and why are the doctors doing it?
I don't know why the parents are allowing it, but the doctor should not do it. Yeah, I mean, it's really disturbing. And I know that my own gynecologist in Berkeley, when I would talk to her about doing this book, and she would go, I mean, she was so disturbed in Berkeley by the number of her patients who were coming in feeling that there was something abnormal about the appearance of their genitals because they were removing their pubic hair and they were comparing it to porn. There's this great, one thing I like to show girls when we talk about this is there's this art project, this art piece called The Great Wall of Vagina. And it's just a, and you can look it up online. And it's, the artist took plaster casts of 400 women's vulvas. And some have hair, some don't have, I mean, they're all different. They're all over the map. And just puts them on a huge wall. And it shows you, I mean, it's like saying that you're worried about whether your fingerprint is normal.
Right.
You know? And it's something that I think women of our generation just can't even wrap our minds around because it's such a foreign concept. But to think that that's been foisted on young women, whether it's in this very extreme canary in a coal mine way or just their concerns that their genitals are prepared so that boys won't be humiliated. They talked about that a lot, you know, is very concerning.
Peggy Ornstein is author of the new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She interviewed more than 70 high school and college age girls across the country about their sex lives. And one of the questions she was thinking about this entire time is, do young women today have more freedom to shape their sexual encounters than their mothers? Peggy will be speaking at Books, Inc. tonight in Berkeley at 7:00 with a high school student. Find more information, yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Your call is a better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. Coming up in a half an hour here on KALW, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say, starting at 11 o'clock, half hour from now.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of the worsening humanitarian crisis in Syria. We will also talk about the continued fallout from the Panama Papers. On Monday, a searchable database will be released online. That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking with best-selling author Peggy Orenstein about her latest book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She interviewed more than 70 high school and college-age girls about sex, internet porn, hookup culture, sexual assault on college campuses, so many different issues. I have to say, reading this book, it was very disturbing, but this conversation is so needed. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. How are young women navigating sex in today's world? How do you talk about the young people in your lives about these issues? And what do you think about this question? Do young women today have more freedom to shape their sexual encounters than their mothers? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We decided to dive in and talk about all of these issues before we talked about these 70 girls.
I know.
So before we get to calls, just give us an overview of the girls you interviewed.
So the young women, what was interesting to me is that the young women that I talked to felt that they could engage in sexual activity, absolutely. They did not necessarily feel entitled to enjoy it. And the girls that I talked to were, they spanned a pretty broad ethnic spectrum, but they were mostly middle class, and they were all college bound or in college. And I chose those girls deliberately because I wanted to talk to girls who felt they had opportunity and who we think of as the beneficiaries, the biggest beneficiaries of the feminist movement. Because I felt like if even those girls who had so much educational attainment, who had such high ambitions, for whom we'd made so much more room in the professions, who, you know, were leaning in all over the place, basically, if even they were toppling in their personal lives, then I knew that we couldn't deny that there was a problem. So, for instance, one of the girls that I spoke with told me that she came from generations of smart, strong women. And she said, you know, my grandma was a firecracker. My mom is strong. And my sister and I, we are loud. And that's our feminine power. And then she started narrating to me her sex life, which was a string of kind of a handful of not very satisfying, not very reciprocal, not very respectful hookups. And she said, I don't know, you know, I think we girls are just socialized to be deferential and not express our needs. And I said, wait, 5 minutes ago you told me how smart and strong you were. And she said, yeah, I just, nobody told me that smart, strong image applied to sex.
And you felt like you were having very honest conversations with these girls because a lot of the questions you asked, they had never been asked before.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I stay in touch with a lot of them because they had, I mean, they were really hungry. I mean, I actually think everybody's hungry for this conversation because the reception to the book has been amazing. Mm. Amazing. It debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, that's beyond my wildest imaginings. But the girls themselves, you know, and one of them recently wrote to me and said she's 21 now. She still hasn't talked to her mom ever about her sex life, and it makes her sad. Mm. And so I really wanted to provide a forum with the book, like a neutral ground kind of, where girls and girls, girls and parents could talk about these issues through the stories in the book without the discomfort of having to talk about their own personal sex life.
Did you ever feel like the girls were telling you what you wanted to hear or to
No.
shock you or anything? No.
Oh, no.
Okay.
I did feel like they often came in with a story to tell. Like they were there, like, for instance, with hookup culture, some of the girls would come in because they wanted to tell me they enjoyed hooking up. And that was fine with them, that they were, you know, focusing on their schoolwork, they were focusing on their friends, they didn't want to have a boyfriend. The hookup culture was, you know, suited that girls are not victims, that they're participants. So sometimes they, but, you know, and with those kinds of things, with hookup culture versus relationships, all of that, it wasn't really my goal to say this is right and this is wrong, or this is how you should engage and this is how you shouldn't, but talk about what you would likely to get and not get. And what they were likely to get was freedom, warm bodies, a war story, feeling desirable. They were much less likely to get good sex or the tools they would need in order to have good sex or create intimacy.
Peggy Ornstein is author of Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape, and she'll be speaking tonight at Books, Inc. in Berkeley with a high school student at 7 o'clock. And let's hear from Jennifer in Berkeley. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on. I am a college-educated, I'm actually heading to law school, woman. I have three children and one daughter. And when I was pregnant with my daughter, and had my daughter, I wanted to see where me and my husband stood on certain issues. And I came up with this question that I've asked all my friends who have gotten pregnant now with daughters, which was, if you had to make a bad choice, I know you're not going to want to make it, but if you had to choose between your daughter in high school being with a boyfriend who is horrible to her, tears down her self-esteem, just is not good, everything you wouldn't want in a guy, he is to her, or would you rather her sleep around and enjoy sex and sleep around because she enjoys it and doesn't care what others think? And every mother chooses sleep around so quickly, and every dad hesitates but usually picks the shitty boyfriend, or the bad boyfriend, sorry. And so I just think it speaks volumes to our society that you would want your daughter to be torn down and just have this horrible, you know, high school life rather than to sleep around and enjoy, you know, if she is enjoying it. So, yeah, I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, well, I think that's you're speaking to something that's really important, which is that we think that relationships are protective of girls, and they aren't necessarily. A healthy relationship is a great thing, but the girls did talk to me about relationship violence, about lowered self-esteem, about, you know, both emotional and physical abuse. And some of the girls also talked about really feeling profound love, gratitude, appreciation in their relationship. So I think, you know, what I hope that we talk about when we educate our children is how to engage, whether your relationship with somebody is going to last for 10 minutes or whether it's going to last for 10 years, how to engage ethically, responsibly, reciprocally, and enjoyably.
Well, thank you for calling in, Jennifer. Let's go next to Chandra in Berkeley. Hi, Chandra. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call and for your important work. I'm a daughter. I'm a daughter, yes, but I'm also a mother of a daughter who's 16, and I live in Berkeley. So I'm wondering, would this be a good talk tonight to bring her to at 7 o'clock in at the Books, Inc.?
Yes. It would. And, you know, I've been getting such great feedback from high school girls on the book, and that's why I really like doing this. The young woman who I'm going to be in conversation with is somebody that I've been in conversation with before, and it's so much fun because we really get her perspective and her sense of what this work means to her and to high school girls. And I think that that's also a bridge for high school girls in the audience. And I had a really funny experience a couple weeks ago. I was at a private school giving a talk for a friend who's a teacher there, and she asked one of the girls in the class to read the book and introduce me. And the girl got up and she said, you know, at first I didn't want to read this book because I thought, what's this old person telling me about myself for, you know? And then she said, I started it. And I read it in 2 days. I didn't stop reading it, and I felt like it was talking to me and about me and validating my experience and giving me all kinds of new perspectives on my experience. So my hope really is that high school, I wouldn't say younger than high school, but that girls in high school and young women in college read the book and that it helps them contextualize their experience and think about what they want. Because honestly, saying to a girl that age, what do you want out of this experience, is so radical.
Hmm.
So radical.
Thank you for calling in, Chandra. Peggy, because you're still in touch with a lot of the girls you interviewed, how has this experience changed their opinion of what they want?
It has changed. It has transformed some of them. It really has. I mean, they would write to me and say, nobody has ever asked me these questions. I've never thought about these things. I mean, kids are just growing up in their world. You know, it's the air they breathe. It's the waters they swim in. Nobody is talking to them. You know, we have very little sex education in schools. Most places, you know, there's still abstinence only. Or if they do have sex education, it's all based on a risk and disease model. Parents don't talk to them. I mean, one of the things that I did that was really important to me as a parent, and I think important in the book, was looking at other countries, and particularly looking at the Dutch. And when they do comparisons of Dutch college women and American college women talking about their early sexual experience, it could not be more different. And the Dutch girls embody everything we want for our girls. Fewer negative consequences like pregnancy, disease, regret, drunkenness, much less of that. Way more positive consequences, you know, enjoying the experience, being able to talk to their partner who they knew very well, preparing for the experience, positive body image. And when they talk about what was different, it's that teachers, parents, and doctors in Holland talk explicitly, frankly, directly to kids about sex from a very early age. And in particular, parents, they're not more comfortable necessarily, but whereas American parents solely talk about risk and danger, Dutch parents frame it as balancing responsibility with joy.
How did that happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting because they were in the same place that we were before the 1970s. Their attitudes towards premarital sex were precisely the same as Americans, which is don't. And they evolved in the same way in terms of public opinion. But when they saw that people were going to have premarital sex and teenage sex, they decided that what they needed to do was create a context in which kids engaged, again, ethically, respectfully, responsibly, pleasurably, and to really open it up and fully educate their kids as they would about anything else, you know, from the get-go. Whereas what we did was fight about it, try to shut it down. Liberals went to risk and danger. And conservatives went to abstinence only. And neither of those models is ideal. Abstinence only is way worse. Mm. It doesn't, you know, there was just another study yesterday that it has higher rates of sexually transmitted disease, results in higher rates of sexually transmitted disease, vastly higher rates of pregnancy. So it's it ends up, the kids have to live with those consequences.
And for various reasons, but a lot of the abstinence-only classes teach that as long as you're not having sex, you might be okay. And is that why we have now what oral sex is now considered second base?
Third base. But yeah. Yeah, you know, I think it's a combination of nobody talking about it, of that's the big change. In fact, kids are not having intercourse at greater rates, or having intercourse at lesser rates, and they're not having intercourse younger. They're not. But they are engaging in other behavior, and particularly oral sex. And again, you know, by calling that not sex and by focusing on virginity as first intercourse, we are missing a big part of the story.
This was another disturbing part of the book, that oral sex became so common, and as a result, STDs have increased.
Yeah.
I mean, you even write that some girls won't go out with their guy friends for fear that they expect oral sex at the end of the night.
Yeah, that was in the kind of more extreme cases. But I just want to go back a second to what I was just about to say,
sure.
Which was that you know, again, we need to expand the definition of sex. We need to talk to kids about the whole range of sexual acts. And one of the places where I really learned and thought about that was in my conversations with gay and bisexual girls. And, you know, I asked one of the – because what they would talk about was getting off the script. And when they got off the script, how they were free to create a sexual experience that was satisfying to them on their own terms. And I asked one of the girls – how did you know when you lost your virginity? Because she had never had vaginal intercourse. And she said, yeah, you know, I wondered that myself. So I Googled it. And Google did not have an answer. So I said, well, so how did you know? And, you know, she kind of hemmed and she hawed and she said, well, I think I wasn't a virgin anymore when I had my first orgasm and with a partner. And I thought, wow, what if just for a minute? I mean, I know, you know, intercourse is a big deal, but it's not the only big deal. Mm-hmm. It's not the only big deal. And it shouldn't define, you know, be the only definition of innocence to experience, because what that does is encourage this rush to a goal. And what this girl was describing more was what we want, which is sexuality as a pool of experience that kids draw from that is about warmth and closeness and affection and desire and arousal and touch and sensation. And you have to, you know, I mean, just asking a young person, who's more experienced, the person who makes out with their partner for 3 hours, who just kisses and learns about erotic tension and sensation, or the person who gets wasted at a party, hooks up with a random and has, you know, it, because they want to unload their virginity before they get to college.
What struck you about the differences with girls in same-sex relationships and how they see or how they talked about pleasure?
Well, one of the things that we, when we talk about sexual satisfaction, is that we think that we're always talking about the same thing. And in fact, it's a gendered thing. And so when college women are more likely than men to measure their satisfaction by their partner's pleasure. So if he had a good time, I had a good time in heterosexual relationships. And college men are more likely than women to measure their satisfaction by their own pleasure. So if I had a good time, I had a good time. That dynamic remains true in same-sex female relationships, the measuring by the partner's pleasure. So suddenly, the rates of orgasm in same-sex encounters for women are the same as men's in heterosexual relationships. So it's a really interesting finding. And I think that we have something to learn from the way that girls behave in same-sex encounters. Mm.
Peggy Ornstein is author of Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She'll be speaking tonight at Books, Inc. with a high school student at 7 o'clock in Berkeley. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Garrett in Oakland. Hi, Garrett. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, did we lose Garrett?
He disappeared.
All right. We'll try to get you back, Garrett, if you give us a call back. Let's go next to Timothy in Berkeley. Hi, Timothy.
Yeah, hello. Thanks. Let's see. I called because I've sort of started to encounter this hookup culture, if you will, more personally, since I've been driving Uber and doing, like, nighttime rides over in the city. And prior to that, I've knew it existed, but I always had sort of held it off to the side. When I would encounter men that were involved in it or spoke about it, it was always sort of like, I don't know, in lower class situations or military or high school people who had no experience whatsoever, I suppose, and were just telling stories. And I've been forced to kind of confront my biases or prejudices about it. I just sort of held it off as something that was out there. And I realized that as I encounter both men and women who are involved in it over there, that, it's been a very difficult process for me. It's actually the worst part of this whole driving job.
Timothy, this is so interesting. Can you elaborate on this? I mean, what are your experiences like when you drive people late at night? I mean, what are you hearing from guys?
Well, I've been amazed at how, you know, these are, you know, like successful, so-called successful, I don't know, upper class, middle class, whatever type people. And I've been amazed at how open they were in just discussing things around a stranger, me, the driver, generally with each other, but sometimes even with me. I find them like high-fiving or bragging about how many women they have on the line at the moment that they're texting to. Occasionally they get a woman on the phone and then they start telling her stories that I know sitting in the car with them that are not true, like they say where they are or what they're about to do, that this aren't true. They're designed to try and get the woman to hook up with them. And I've had guys or couples that I thought were couples, but it turns out it was just they met each other that night, and he tries to convince her to let him come upstairs. And one time she eventually refused, and he kept moaning that he had to go home and he'd be lonely and so on. And as soon as she got out of the car, he told me to take him back to the bar where I had picked him up to begin with. And it's it just becomes so much, you know, that just seems like it's ubiquitous or it's a huge thing, and I just never realized how big it was, how, and I've realized also, like, my wife was a part of that culture to some degree when she was beginning her experience sexually, and now that makes it sort of personal for me. And I never wanted to think of her being involved in that situation. And then I noticed that when I try to warn women about what goes on in these areas, I don't know, it's just been really complicated for me. It's been, I don't know, I just called because it just sort of struck a nerve.
Thank you so much for calling, Timothy.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you brought up men, because one of the things that was really important to me was to bring boys into the conversation. And so I very deliberately ended the book in the classroom of a woman in Marin named Karis Dennison, who goes around to schools in the Bay Area, high schools and middle schools, and educates around these issues. And she really believes, and I really observed in her classroom, the way that boys and girls worked out these issues of ethics and respect and pleasure and all of these things together. And one of my favorite moments was when a young man raised his hand and he said, "You know that baseball metaphor that we use for sex? In baseball, there's winners and there's losers. So who's the loser supposed to be in sex?" And I thought, yeah, bingo, because that is, you know, that is a terrible metaphor. And that boy, I think he made this profound, it was small, but a profound shift in how he views his encounters. And again, whether he goes into one that's 10 minutes or 10 years, he will see his partner more as a partner and less as an adversary. Mm. And I love, you know, the Al Vernacchio, who's an educator in Pennsylvania, uses the pizza metaphor for sex, which is, I think, far superior, because, you know, with pizza, first of all, you decide if you're hungry. Maybe you're not hungry, you know? And then you go out, you decide, okay, we're going to go for pizza. Then you negotiate the toppings together. And, you know, maybe you like mushrooms, Rose, and I like pepperoni. And so we go halvesies. Or, you know, if I keep trying to insist on pepperoni and you keep kosher, you're not going to have pizza with me anymore, right? I mean,
right.
It's all about a shared experience and being invested in the other person's pleasure. Nobody shoves pizza down your throat. You know, I mean, it's again, this pool, this horizontal idea instead of this vertical race to a goal.
When you talk about this in schools, what response do you get from boys?
I will be honest with you that I am generally asked to talk to girls.
Hmm.
But I did recently I did a co-ed thing, but then after, I was only talking to girls, so I didn't really get to hear how boys talk. But I have gotten letters across a spectrum from young men, and an educator in the Bay Area who teaches sex ed sent me some letters from her boys, and they were a spectrum from boys who said, you know, I'm an ally of girls. I totally agree, you know, with much of this. This is who I am in relationships. I try to really respect. I'm ethical, regardless of what kind of, you know, if it's a hookup or relationship. And boys who said, if girls don't like it, they should just say no. I mean, it was the whole spectrum that you see not only among boys, but among adult men, I think.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to make sure that we don't just leave this for parents who maybe are struggling with this, or parents who are just thinking about these issues. So what are your thoughts? I mean, you've got a young girl.
She's
going into eighth grade next year.
She will be going into eighth grade next year.
How did this entire experience change the way you talk to your daughter?
It really did. It really did change. And again, it's balancing responsibility and joy, because I think in a really weird way, we are more comfortable talking about girls as victims than as agents of their sexuality.
Right.
And you have to talk about how girls are going to, how to help them express their needs, wants, and desires, as well as their limits, and have those be respected. Talking about pleasure, talking about masturbation, talking about things. And I know you think your daughter doesn't want to hear it, but you don't really get to pick and choose when you parent. So I think it's really, and if you can't do it, get people on your team, you know, that aunt. I've been that friend. And I went out with a young woman, a friend of mine's daughter, when she was 16, and said, who was thinking about having intercourse. We talked about safety, talked about disease, and, you know, and then I said, but I want to ask you some questions.
Have you ever masturbated? Have you had an orgasm on your own? Have you had an orgasm with your partner? Can you tell him what you want, what you don't want, what you like, what you don't like? And if you can't, what are you hoping to get out of this exactly? And she just looked at me. She didn't really say anything. But now that young woman is 24, and we talk all the time about her personal life, about her graduate school applications. And I feel like that door, I opened the door that day, and I said, I am here. You can talk to me. I will hear you. I will not judge you. And I will do my best to be your advisor on your team. So build the team if you can't do it yourself.
And have you talked to boys like this?
You know, that's a really interesting question, Rose, because I hadn't for a long time. I have 8 nieces and 2 nephews. And I had talked to the girls, and I suddenly went, whoops. And since actually, you know, pretty late in the game with the book, I have sat down with particularly my younger nephew and said, you know, now it's time for the Aunt Peg talk with you. And developing that relationship has been really great, but I've had to really, like, walk my talk and just say, okay, yeah, I am embarrassed. I would like the floor to swallow me up right now before I say these words. And so what? I don't get to make that choice. We need to have this conversation.
It would be interesting to have this book, Girls and or Boys and Sex, the same kind of book.
Yes, it would, and that is what I'm told everywhere I go. I'm thinking about that.
Peggy Ornstein is author of Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She'll be speaking tonight at Books, Inc. with a high school student at 7 o'clock. It's the Books, Inc. in Berkeley. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And Peggy, we couldn't get to all of our emails and phone calls. I mean, people really want to talk about these issues, so we would love to have you back.
I would love that.
All right. Thank you for coming
in. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the worsening humanitarian crisis in Syria. The recent hospital bombing has killed 250 people and devastated the ancient city of Aleppo. We'll also talk about the continued fallout from the Panama Papers, the largest journalistic leak in history. On Monday, a searchable database will be released online. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.